I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
The only way American democracy can function is through compromise and consensus. And that's what I work to do as your president. You know, to forge bipartisan agreement where it's possible and where it's needed.
President Biden addresses the nation just before signing a bipartisan bill to suspend the debt ceiling to avert a historic default. Biden calls it a big win, but many progressives disagree. We'll speak to David Sirota of The Lever. Then we continue our conversation with a father who spent two decades trying to hold the billionaire Sackler family accountable for their role in the opioid epidemic.
Eddie was a high school senior, normal kid. The first time I heard the word OxyContin, my son was in his bed, dead.
We'll talk to Ed Beach, the founder of RAP, Relatives Against Purdue Pharma, against the Sacklers receiving immunity last week from civil lawsuits as part of a $6 billion settlement that'll allow the founders of Purdue Pharma to preserve much of their fortune. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In India, at least 275 people were killed and over 1,000 injured in the eastern state of Odisha Friday when a packed passenger train crashed into an oncoming freight train, causing another passenger train to derail. The number of victims could rise as more bodies are identified. One 55-year-old survivor witnessed her daughter perish in the disaster.
My daughter got buried under bulky iron right in front of my eyes. I managed to stand in a corner, but I was hit in the head by some iron rod or something. I thought about how to get my daughter out from underneath the iron, but didn't know how to move such heavy iron. My daughter kept crying and died right in front of my eyes.
Authorities say an electronic signaling system failure appears to be at fault as they start their investigation of one of the deadliest rail disasters in decades. Many of the passengers were students or migrant and day laborers. The tragedy has put the safety of India's rail system, which carries some 8 billion passengers a year, in its spotlight. While India has made substantial investments in its transportation infrastructure, spending on track maintenance and other security measures has decreased. The Ukrainian military says it's moving forward near Bakhmut, which Russia claimed it captured in May after months of bloody battles. This comes after Russia said it repelled a Ukrainian offensive in the Donetsk region, killing hundreds of troops. Russia's claims have not been verified. It's not clear if Ukraine has yet launched its long-anticipated counteroffensive. Over the weekend, a Russian air raid on the central city of Dnipro injured over 20 people and killed a 2-year-old girl, according to Ukrainian officials. The UN says over 525 children have been killed since the start of the invasion in February of last year. Meanwhile, Italian Cardinal Matteo Zuppi is in Kyiv today after Pope Francis appointed him to lead a papal peace mission to end the Ukraine war. Sudan's army has brought in reinforcements as it seeks to defeat the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in Khartoum. The move has raised fears of intensified fighting in Sudan's capital after a ceasefire agreement expired, leaving the two sides battling for control of a contested military base and other sites. Elsewhere, heavy fighting continues in Sudan's western Darfur region, where at least 40 people were killed, dozens more wounded over the weekend. Witnesses say gangs of armed fighters have carried out widespread looting and terrorize civilians, worsening the humanitarian crisis. President Biden signed legislation raising the debt ceiling Saturday, averting a first-ever default on the national debt.
No one got everything they wanted, but the American people got what they needed. We averted an economic crisis, an economic collapse.
The deal comes after drawn-out negotiations between Biden and Republican leaders, whom Democrats blasted for taking the economy hostage to force spending cuts. The agreement cuts food assistance for hungry people and fast-tracks the frack gas Mountain Valley pipeline while protecting tax cuts for the rich and enriching military contractors. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced Friday new oil and gas leases will not be permitted on public lands in and around the Chaco Canyon National Historical Park in New Mexico. The ban will be in effect for 20 years, but only affects new leases. It comes after decades of organizing by indigenous groups, which consider Chaco Canyon a sacred site. Three corporations that produce a class of toxic substances, commonly called forever chemicals, have agreed to pay $1.2 billion to settle liability claims brought by municipal water agencies who say the companies knowingly contaminated drinking water supplies around the United States. DuPont and two spinoff companies, Chemours and Corteva, will pay into a fund to help remove the chemicals known as PFAS, which can take centuries to break down in the environment. They're used in everything from food packaging to cosmetics to fabrics and firefighting foam. PFAS have been found in the blood of nearly all U.S. residents and in a majority of people around the world. They're linked to a host of health problems in humans, including liver damage, lowered fertility, asthma, thyroid problems, low infant birth weight, and cancer. Delegates from more than 170 nations have agreed to draft the first global treaty aimed at reducing plastic waste after a week of UN-brokered negotiations in Paris. Delegates to the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution will review the draft agreement at their next round of talks in November. Environmental groups are calling on governments not to allow fossil fuel companies and other industry interests to water down the agreement. This is Samoa's delegate addressing the forum on behalf of the Alliance of Small Islands States.
Small island developing states inherit much of the plastic waste from all across the globe, despite our negligible contribution to the creation. These plastics wash upon our shores, threaten the livelihoods of our people, hinder our tourism and fisheries industries, among others, and suffocate our ecosystems. As stewards of the oceans and seas, we reiterate the urgent need for an agreement that is ambitious from the start, comprehensive across the whole life cycle of plastics, addresses legacy plastics in the marine environment, and one that becomes more robust over time.
Saudi Arabia has agreed to cut oil production by a further 1 million barrels per day after a weekend meeting of OPEC Plus members in Vienna, Austria. The move will likely push global oil prices higher. It follows cuts of 3.7 million barrels of oil per day by OPEC Plus over the past year. The Biden administration's criticized the cuts, saying increased profits from higher energy prices could benefit Russia. In Senegal, at least 15 people have been killed after police began a crackdown on protests staged by supporters of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. The crackdown began after a Senegalese court on Thursday sentenced him to 2 years in prison over an alleged sexual assault. He's accused the government of manufacturing charges against him to derail his candidacy. Sonko is popular among Senegal's youth and a likely candidate in the 2024 presidential election. This is a student who joined protests in the capital, Dakar, Friday.
It's unfortunate. We don't want things to be like this, because we all want to learn and finish the year. But since the state has done what it wants, we too have our opinion. That's it.
In the German city of Leipzig, dozens of people were arrested or detained over the weekend as police clashed with protesters and authorities sought to ban demonstrations following the conviction last week of an anti-fascist activist. 28-year-old Lena A. received 5 years in prison for attacking neo-Nazis. Three others received sentences of 2 to 3 years. Activists decried the violent crackdown on protests and public assembly.
It's unbelievable experiencing how repressive the state and police are against anti-fascist protesters. It's exactly the same response to climate activists, but we are standing strong together in solidarity.
Back in the United States, California authorities have launched an investigation after at least 16 asylum seekers were flown to Sacramento Friday in a private jet believed to have been arranged by the state of Florida. The migrants, who are from Venezuela and Colombia, say they were promised work if they boarded the flight, but were instead dropped off in front of a church with only a backpack's worth of belongings. The group had entered the U.S. through the Texas border and were transported by bus to New Mexico, where they were put on the charter jet to California. Officials say the migrants had paperwork appearing to link the flight to Florida. California's attorney general called the move a state-sanctioned kidnapping. Last year, officials working for Republican Governor Ron DeSantis helped coordinate similar flights, coercing dozens of asylum seekers to go to Martha's Vineyard under the false promise they'd be given jobs and housing. In more immigration news, an investigation into last month's death of 8-year-old Anadith Tanay Reyes Alvarez reveals Customs and Border Protection officials refused to call an ambulance for the girl despite her history of medical problems and even after she presented with a fever of nearly 105 degrees Fahrenheit. She'd been detained with her family by CBP for at least 9 days before she died. Her mother pleaded for help but was ignored until the young girl had a seizure and was finally taken to a hospital where she was pronounced dead about an hour later. A federal judge has ruled Tennessee's law banning drag shows is unconstitutional. The Trump-appointed judge said in a decision released Friday the legislation was overly broad and encouraged discriminatory enforcement. Tennessee's law was signed by Republican Governor Bill Lee in March and comes as part of an onslaught of attacks on the rights of LGBTQ people. On Saturday, people who attended the Pride event in Franklin, Tennessee, celebrating the ruling. This is drag performer Cian Hale.
Having the answer finally delivered and that breath of fresh air and that weight off our shoulders that it's finally gone, we don't have to worry about it, is lovely. We can breathe easy for the rest of the year. There's still a fight and we still have to continue fighting. There's still other states that drag is still being criminalized that we still have to work on, but this is definitely a step in the right direction.
Unionized workers at shipping ports across the West Coast, including in Los Angeles and Oakland, California, have walked off the job as union negotiations demanding better working conditions and benefits continue. In other labor news, the Directors Guild of America has reached a tentative contract agreement with Hollywood studios covering pay, streaming residuals, and protections against AI, artificial intelligence. The Writers Guild of America remains on strike. Meanwhile, journalists and staff working at Gannett, the country's largest newspaper chain, are leading a one-day strike today as the media company holds its annual shareholders meeting. Workers are demanding shareholders take a vote of no confidence against Mike Reed, Gannett's chief executive, and allow for new leadership. And Amazon on Friday abruptly fired union organizer Jennifer Bates, who's been a leading spokesperson of the unionization campaign by warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama. Bates often spoke out against Amazon's workplace safety issues and its attacks on union efforts, including in Congress and on Democracy Now! In 2021.
The reason why we're organizing is because we need an even playing field. Some of the conditions that are in there are being ignored by human resources, long work hours with only two breaks, long walks upstairs and downstairs. So we want to be heard. We want to be treated like people and not ignored when we have issues. People are getting fired without having their opportunity to speak their side.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Next up, President Biden signs a bipartisan bill to suspend the debt ceiling to avert a historic default, calling it a big win. But many progressives disagree. We'll speak with David Sirota of The Lever. Stay with us.
Baby, I love. Baby, I love. Too many people you used to know. They see you coming, they see you go. They know your secrets.
You know. Lost Cause by Beck. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden has signed a debt ceiling deal into law that averts a historic default by the United States. In his first address from the Oval Office, Biden said passing this budget agreement was critical.
American democracy can function is through compromise and consensus. And that's what I work to do as your president. You know, to forge bipartisan agreement where it's possible and where it's needed.
Progressives who oppose the bipartisan deal cited new cuts it imposes on key social programs and expanded work requirements for some recipients of food stamps. The legislation was called a dirty deal by climate activists because it rolls back the National Environmental Policy Act and fast-tracks the approval and construction of the Frack Gas Mountain Valley Pipeline through West Virginia and Virginia, a pet project of the powerful conservative Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Meanwhile, critics say lobbyists prevented the debt bill from including tax reforms and repealing high-income tax cuts. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who voted no, spoke Saturday at a rally to raise the wage in Charleston, South Carolina.
In this moment in American history, we have a choice. Either we abdicate our responsibilities to our kids and future generations, and we allow a handful of billionaires to consolidate their wealth and their power, or we stand up and fight back.
For more, we're joined in Denver, Colorado, by David Sirota, award-winning investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Lever, where his latest piece is headlined, "This is what Biden says is a big win." Sirota is also editor-at-large for Jacobin. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. Okay, can you just lay out who you think gained and lost in this historic debt signing deal? Historic because it would have been the first time, if it hadn't been signed, that the country defaulted.
Well, certainly the fossil fuel industry is a big winner here, as you alluded to with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, expediting that controversial pipeline, which many say will be a climate bomb at a time of a climate emergency. So the fossil fuel industry, a huge winner here. Defense contractors, military contractors, also a big winners in this deal in which it approved the Pentagon budget going up to another record level. Private student lenders who have wanted the end of the private student lending moratorium, they are big winners here. They have been lobbying for that. One major private student lender, its stock began rising as soon as this deal was being finalized. And then, of course, the very rich. Again, as you alluded to, there were no measures in this debt bill to repeal the high-income tax cuts that are responsible, primarily responsible, for the increase in the debt ratio that was supposed to be at issue in this bill. In fact, in addition to not repealing those high-income tax cuts, the bill also cuts a large amount of funding from the IRS, and the IRS is specifically its functions to enforce the basic tax laws already on the books as they relate to the very wealthy. We have a very big situation in this country where hundreds of billions of dollars of owed taxes go unpaid by the richest Americans. That funding was supposed to be to do that kind of crackdown. Now it has been moved out into other programs. So those are the big winners in this bill.
The losers.
Well, the losers are everybody else. The losers, in particular, very, very poor people. As you discussed, the changes to the food stamp program to make it harder for lots of people to access food stamps at a time of an affordability crisis, that's a big loss. I think student debtors, in the middle of an affordability crisis, you've got student debt payments that are going to start up again. So basically, the working class of this country was deeply harmed by this bill. And I would say this, the president celebrating this bill as a big win. In other words, instead of saying this is something that we had to do, and we can go over whether he actually had to do it, he didn't have to do this. But instead of saying we had to do this, it's kind of unfortunate. Going out and celebrating this as a big win is an admission about what the Democratic president and the Democratic Party see as a win and for whom they think they want to secure such victories. It's all now out on the table. It's all now there for everybody to see. And it's important to remember that we didn't have to be at this point. The Democratic Party controlled both houses of Congress in the lame duck and chose not to pass a clean debt ceiling bill. They chose not to. At the time, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois simply said the party did not feel like making time. at the end of the congressional session to do that. So the point being is, this is exactly the result that the Democratic Party wanted. They wanted to work with Republicans to get to these exact policies, and now they are celebrating that. So I think we all need to take a moment to say, okay, this is what the Democratic president and the Democratic Party, working alongside the Republican Party, this is what it actually wants.
So, obviously, you agree that if the U.S. had defaulted, it would have created an absolute catastrophe. But you say, aside from even having negotiated the deal on the lame duck when the Democrats were in control, that Biden had this option of the 14th Amendment and didn't take it. Talk about the significance of that.
Sure. The Constitution makes pretty clear that the U.S. government is empowered above statutes, if you will, to deal with the debt and make sure it does not default on its debt. Progressive lawmakers had asked the Biden administration to use this power to avert this entire manufactured crisis. And almost as soon as that proposal was floated by those lawmakers, the Biden White House said no, they're not even going to pursue it. And again, I think you put that together with the fact that they didn't try to pass a clean debt ceiling bill during the lame duck session when Democrats controlled the Congress. And what you see is a picture of a party that wanted this outcome. Overlay it, by the way, with one other layer, with the fact that Joe Biden, throughout his career, has given floor speeches on the floor of the Senate, has made clear that he wants to work with Republicans to cut spending, cut funding for social programs. So I think we have to step back and realize this is a moment of honesty, a moment of clarity of where at least the leadership of the Democratic Party is when it comes to things like budget austerity.
Let me ask you about your piece on Republican presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis, right, the Florida governor. Headline, Florida lawmakers help DeSantis shovel more cash to Wall Street, in which you report how DeSantis' fundraising for his 2024 presidential bid could be hindered by a federal pay-to-play rule that restricts campaign contributions from financial executives to state officials who control pension investment decisions. Explain.
Ron DeSantis, as the governor, is one of three people who control Florida's massive public employee pension system. About 10, 15 years ago, an anti-corruption law was passed in the wake of corruption scandals at pension systems, which said basically that the financial managers who are given money to manage by public officials to manage those monies on behalf of retirees, they cannot give money to politicians who control that money, because the decisions about who gets to invest those monies need to be made based purely on merit, not on political influence. As we report at The Lever, and folks can find at levernews.com, our story shows that under DeSantis, Florida pension money was moved to various financial firms whose executives were giving money to political groups that ultimately ended up boosting Ron DeSantis's political campaigns. Now, there's a question about whether they used intermediary groups to try to get around that very clear anti-corruption law. But moving forward, as DeSantis tries to raise money for his presidential campaign, this anti-corruption law is there to make sure that financial managers benefiting from his decisions and how he apportions the retirement funding for teachers, firefighters, other public employees, that rule is there to try to make sure that he doesn't use that leverage. He's not able to use that leverage to raise money from the financial firms that could get that money and earn big fees off that money. So it could provide a very serious obstacle for DeSantis to raise lots of money if the law, and it's a big if that law is enforced.
You say this isn't a theoretical problem. About a decade ago, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's running again, throwing his hat in the ring for president this week, as well as Texas Governor Rick Perry, both faced the same fundraising obstacle with their own GOP presidential campaigns. Quoting a Christie top advisor, admitting there is no way around it, there are no loopholes.
Yeah. It's a very, very clear law. And let's be clear about how it works. It's designed to deter the financial managers from giving the money, because the financial managers are the ones who can get punished. If you give money, if you're a giant private equity firm and you give money to your executives, give money to Ron DeSantis, and the Florida pension fund is giving you money to manage, the law can basically say you can't manage that money anymore. So it creates a financial deterrent to Wall Street firms to engage in that kind of financial fundraising for political candidates. So, yes, it could be a huge obstacle for DeSantis. But again, I go back to the if. Will the Biden administration's Securities and Exchange Commission actually enforce this law? Will the law actually be taken seriously by regulators? Will the law be applied to super PACs, some of which seem designed to get around these kinds of laws? That's the big question for campaign finance here right now.
And finally, David Sirota, as many Republican presidential candidates throw their hat in the ring, from South Carolina's Tim Scott, as well as Nikki Haley, to Chris Christie, to the North Carolina, to the North Dakota governor, and of course DeSantis. If you can talk about, and Vice President Pence this week, what you're watching.
Well, look, I think the Republican primary is going to be essentially an arms race for how extreme each candidate can try to position themselves. They're going to be in a battle to show who's more extreme on immigration, who's more extreme on budget cutting, who's more extreme on trying to push for larger Pentagon budgets and the like. So I think watching that and seeing how extreme it gets is going to be important. I also think on the Democratic side, seeing whether the party is going to pursue an agenda which says we are a party that is going to deliver for the working class, or whether the party is going to try to position itself in much the way you heard Joe Biden starting to position himself as a quote unquote bipartisan conciliator. My view is that the Democratic Party has a very, very serious risk in this election if it is not constantly showing that it is delivering for the working class. If it is trying to only show that it wants to work with Republicans instead of saying our agenda is to deliver real material gains for the working class. If the party's agenda is not that, if it is more of a bipartisan conciliation message, I think that puts at risk in a very real way the 2024 election.
David Sirota, award-winning investigative journalist and founder of the news website The Lever. We'll link to your pieces. This is what Biden says is a big win, as well as your piece on Ron DeSantis and Wall Street. Coming up, we continue our conversation with the father who spent 20 years trying to hold the billionaire Sackler family accountable for its role in the opioid epidemic and the death of his 18-year-old son. Back in 30 seconds.
Trusted in the invisible when I was young. Practiced 20 years.
Memory by Tom Berlin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the opioid epidemic, which has killed over 500,000 people in the United States over the last 20 years. Last week, a federal appeals court granted members of the billionaire Sackler family immunity from all current and future civil litigation related to their role in creating and fueling the opioid epidemic. The Sacklers are the owners of Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, the drug many say helped fuel the opioid epidemic. In exchange for civil liability, the Sacklers have agreed to pay a $6 billion settlement out over some 18 years. But due to the terms of the settlement, the Sacklers are expected to keep much of their fortune. We turn now to part two of our conversation with Ed Bish, the founder of RAP, Relatives Against Purdue Pharma. He formed the group after his 18-year-old son, Eddie, died of an OxyContin-related overdose in 2001. But first, we go to investigative reporter Christopher Glazek. He wrote the first article in 2017 documenting how the Sacklers were profiting from the highly addictive drug. I asked Christopher Glazek to talk more about who the Sacklers are.
The Sacklers, you know, have been one of the richest families in the United States for decades. They first got super rich in the 60s, actually with a different drug, with Valium. And their billions and billions came in the 90s with OxyContin. And what the Sackler's have always been really, really good at is selling a highly addictive drug, often a deadly drug in the case of OxyContin. And they've been really, really good at getting doctors to prescribe this addictive drug for an enormous universe of patients. So originally, they had this other drug, basically the same as OxyContin, except it was morphine instead of oxycodone. And that originally was just for cancer patients, and that was in the 80s. And people kind of figured, okay, if you have terminal cancer, who cares if you get addicted? You're going to die. We don't really care what happens in the last year of your life. Well, what the Sacklers did when that drug ran out of patent, they said, what if we took basically the same drug, and instead of targeting it at cancer patients, we target